Forma, a new podcast featuring conversations with authors, teachers, creators, and community leaders who are carefully contemplating the nature and practice of classical education, aesthetic wonder, and Christian community. I'm David Kern. Classical education in America, at least the renewal of it, is old enough now that graduates of it are making waves themselves in the community. Several years ago, Andrew Kern had the privilege of teaching in Boise, Idaho at a Great Books co-op and at a school that is now called the Ambrose School. And while he was there, he taught a young man named Ty Rollins. Ty and his wife, Jenny, are living in Oxford in England now, where they're both studying. And you may know their names because they have been speakers on the classical education conference circuit for several years. But now they're over there studying deeper what classical education means, trying to think about how it can be applied and how to most accurately and effectively and fully live out the ideas that this renewal has been talking about. They've been thinking hard about what it means to be truly classical, both in the classroom and in your individual study. They've been thinking about ways to refine their own teaching and their own studying. And they've been asking some great questions along the way and thus generating some great conversations. So I wanted to have them on Forma to discuss their experiences over there in Oxford, to discuss their experiences growing up in classical education, and to discuss how both of those things are affecting how they're thinking about classical education moving forward. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. It's always great to talk to people who are the fruit of this classical education renewal, who have been around it, both as a teacher and as a student, and who therefore have a pretty well-rounded understanding of what works and what doesn't work, and who have the right questions to ask to generate great conversation. So without further ado, here's my recent conversation with Ty and Jenny Rollins. They joined me on Skype from Oxford, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. So my first question is sort of about your story, I suppose. You both were raised in classical education circles. Jenny, you were homeschooled, is that right? For at least for a while?
Yeah, I was homeschooled up through 10th grade. Homeschooled meaning I had tutorials and
right.
groups in which we did things like read Shakespeare and did labs, but my studies were done under the umbrella of homeschooling.
And the same is true of you, right, Ty?
I was homeschooled from 4th grade through 12th grade. And kind of like Jenny's family, my mom eventually got around to calling it home-based education because there was a lot of things outside the home, like co-op classes that were a big part of it.
Yeah, yeah. So what did that, did your years in homeschooling... did you come out of those saying, oh, I'm definitely going to be involved in classical education after that? Or did it take you a while to kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say wander, but to wander back to classical education? Jenny, I'll let you answer that one first. unless you want Ty to go first.
Ty, do you want to go first?
Well, I feel like it's the same story. So why don't you tell it?
Okay. That's interesting.
Okay. I don't know if it'll be the same story, but I don't know, honestly, David, that I thought very self-consciously, oh, I'm being classically educated when I was being homeschooled. And looking, I mean, the question, what do we mean by classical education is, I think, one that is very much up in the air. So if you mean by that we read great books and attempted to do Latin and had music class, I did have a classical education to a certain extent, but I don't think I thought very self-consciously about it. And I certainly did not plan to have anything to do with education. My mom always said, you would be a great teacher. And I always said, over my dead body. And I think,
well, it turns out she was right then.
Yeah. That's kind of you to say, but it really wasn't until the end of undergraduate and ending up sort of working for Ambrose that I really started thinking about myself as someone who was involved in classical education.
So how did you end up at Ambrose then? Like you were, you said you were finishing up your undergrad, and was it just one of those scenarios where you needed a job, so you got a job, or was there some other motivating force that wanted you to go, that you wanted to go specifically to Ambrose?
Yeah, well, there's a long story behind that decision, but to make it short, we moved to Boise. I finished my undergrad half a year early because we got married. And Ty had a job in Boise, so we moved to Boise. And because of my classical education, David Goodwin, who was at the time the headmaster of Ambrose, really wanted me to come and help with curriculum development. And then a fifth grade position opened up, and I was going to do that part-time, ended up doing it full-time, and fell in love with teaching. And I suppose what I would call now the huge field of research and pioneering and, reviving a sort of lost tradition that I found in particularly at Ambrose, but then in the movement as a whole, as it was taking shape in the States.
So Ty, you ended up in the business world though, right? After college?
Yeah, that's right. So, I was working at Hewlett Packard in Boise. And then, after we got married, Jenny and I were involved a little bit with homeschoolers in our church. And then when Jenny went to Ambrose, I got involved at Ambrose a little bit as well. And, you know, I would say, excuse me, I was definitely aware that I was classically educated. And I, to some extent, chose where I went to university in order to stick with that. And so that was a pretty key category for me. I wasn't planning to come back and teach. In fact, I was just planning to work. But we sort of ended up getting asked to do these classes. And then I ended up choosing to get involved at Ambrose because I felt like, you know, that was an important thing to do just in terms of a community involvement activity. And I enjoyed it a lot. I was teaching a rhetoric class to 10th graders. It's just that's a fun thing to do, frankly.
Yeah.
And from there, you know, Jenny being so much involved, I was on the periphery of the school all the time, even while I was working. And I think my experience working where I really find I use a lot of my letters, education, and the style of thinking that's cultivated in classical ed. I use that at work as much or more as I use my technical training. So that's left me sort of desiring to bring those two spaces together in any way I can.
So this is a different topic for a different conversation probably, but do you ever get people at work who are like, hey, how'd you get so smart? You know, and like, and
no.
Like where you can answer your classical, where you can answer, you know, some where they ask you, you know, and the conversation then leads to your classical education, so to speak. Is that ever a topic of conversation?
Yeah. Okay. Well, people who know me and know my background will say they see elements, of my background in my work, and they appreciate it. So, yeah. I mean, I do a significant amount of writing, a significant amount of sort of persuasive speaking on my feet.
Yeah.
And so it comes out in those ways.
Yeah. So in what ways I guess this is for both of you. I'll go back to you first, Jenny. In what ways did growing up around classical education, even if you didn't necessarily call it that when you were, say, 14 or 15, but in what ways did growing up around it influence your further studies and influence your desire, your desires as a teacher, the way you thought about teaching, the way you approached the day to day, the way you approached the classroom? Would you say that there have been any clear things that kind of motivated or inspired the way that you do those things?
That's such a good question, David. Yes, I think the answer is absolutely. And the first thing that came to mind when you were asking that question is language and words and the centrality of reading. I always tell my mom that I think the very best thing that she did for me as a child, both of my parents really, was to first to talk to me all the time and then to read me. I literally remember as, you know, maybe a 3 or 4 year old picking out stacks of books taller than myself that my mom could then read down to me the whole day. So I once remember there was this sort of overhanging, you know, in houses where there's the kitchen and then there's a bar, a countertop bar that sticks out.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sort of people can lean up against. And I remember as a child going to the library, coming home with enough books to fit between the floor and the top, you know, sort of the top of the counter, stacking them up to the top. And then sort of sitting on the floor and just having mom read to me through that whole entire stack. And then I remember, you know, discovering Shakespeare and reading Beowulf, and then gradually teachers who led us through Shakespeare plays. And then especially a few teachers in my undergraduate who introduced me to commonplace books and then led amazing discussions. And so I think really remembering that the Trivium is based in a love and a valuation of language, of the written and the spoken word, words as things that are precious and beautiful, that carry more than just signification of a thing. So there's more than, you know, the word book means a paper object, or the word desk means the thing that I sit at and write at. That there's effective power and grace that's in relationship, that's communicated through the use of language. And I think that was the thing that was, even if unconsciously, that is part of the heritage of classical education that I was given as a child. And that definitely is, I think if I were to say that I wanted to give my students one love, it would be a love for language, a love for literature.
So even if it's not named as such, that it's still a truth that's imparted to our children, to our students, and that's what happened for you. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I would hope so. And beyond that, a joy in learning. I think the phrase love for learning has been used so much that it's cliche, but when I look around even at university students that I, you know, spend my days with now, I don't think most people expect to love learning, to take great joy in it, but I expect to. I expect to be delighted and surprised and to have so much fun with the things that I'm studying and teaching. And I think that that expectation, which can be greedy at times, but which and is definitely a gift, but that expectation that learning is delightful is something that is an inherent part of classical education that I was given.
Todd, do you think that that kind of love of learning is something that is learned and cultivated, or is that something that is just innate to Jenny?
Wow. It might be innate to Jenny, but I think it's
maybe that's not a fair question to ask you. I don't know.
I mean, other people have it too.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we've gone through our whole life, bumping into those kinds of folks, and some of them are the kind who have, been imparted a classical education, a love of learning, and taking it and run with it. And then some of them, I'm even thinking of someone that we've met here in Oxford, who maybe it was innate because they wouldn't have gotten a classical education naturally, and yet they went out and got one of their own almost. So maybe it goes both ways. I think it's definitely clear when it's absent. From somebody, and that's a tragedy.
Can you think, Ty, in of your own childhood and your own, you know, formative studies, of examples where that idea of a love of learning was imparted to you, that there was something that your teachers or your parents did that was effective in teaching you that it's okay to love learning, or showing you what it looks like to love learning, or just enabled you to love your own studies?
A thing that they did.
Maybe that's not something that teachers do. You know, I don't know if maybe that's something that teachers can only do almost unconsciously themselves.
Certainly the fact that my teachers loved learning made a huge difference. I think that makes it possible for a student to dive into it. So, you know, the classical part of my education really came into to being in my later, you know, junior high and high school. And I'd always loved to read sort of as a pastime, as a hobby, you know, the Lord of the Rings or things like that.
Yeah.
But to unfold that into a real imbibing of literature and history and sort of the richness of thought that can go into contemplating these great ideas from all sides, you know, it's not just a enjoyable keep turning the page kind of thing. I think that has to be modeled, and it was modeled for me by several people. And once you have a model, the student or I could taste and get the hang of it.
My sister teaches in Africa right now, and I know, Jenny, you've been there a couple of times, right?
Yeah, I have. I want to go back.
Yeah. So one of the things she was telling us recently, you know, she tutors, I guess it's more like she teaches all those subjects. High school, they're orphans, and they're kind of preparing them in some ways to come to be able to go to college, maybe even in America or in Europe. And she said that so many of the children have never been. They've never been read to, and they've and let alone hardly ever even been spoken to. And you know, part of it's because they were orphans, certainly, but that there's not a culture, at least where she is, of, you know, deep communication with children, even not necessarily on deep ideas, but just consistent, continued personal communication with children. And she talked about how, because of that, so often when they come to school, there's the things that studies demand of you, you know, the ability to communicate, the desire to communicate, those things just aren't innate in them. Even the kids who are, you would consider generally smart, quote unquote, you know, or who would be good students, even they don't seem to have that. I don't know if I would say capacity, but they don't have that habit ingrained in them, because from a young age, there was no culture of doing that. And I just was thinking how sad that is, and how, you know, if there's one thing that classical education, to speak to what you're saying, Jenny, that if there's one thing that it can do most effectively in our culture right now is to help cultivate that cultural habit of discussing things with children and reading together, and things that even in our world seem to be, even in our culture, I guess the American culture, well, you're not in America right now, but, you know, those things seem to be forgotten. If there's one thing that classical education can actually do right now, it's that.
Yeah, I think that's so true, David. And I think that it's both easier and harder sometimes than we think it is, because, like you said, just speaking, just memorizing some poetry and reading some stories makes a world of difference. And that isn't so hard to do. But I also think, I mean, in the States, I think that's one of the big differences that living in Europe has really emphasized for me. I mentioned that the greatest gift that I was given as a child was being read to and spoken to so much. But the one thing I would go back and change about my education, and the one thing that I would change about all American education, is the fact that we think it's normal to only speak one language. And that's unheard of here. everyone, you know, anywhere else you go in Europe, the question that I'm always asked is, okay, well, obviously you speak English, you're an American, but what other languages do you speak? And the answer that is assumed is that I would speak at least three or four. And people are just absolutely shocked to find out that really the only language that I speak is English. And so, and I think that there's, when I watch American students, and I almost wonder if some of the poverty in our literary output in the Anglo-speaking world stems from the fact that we can only think through one set of linguistic eyes. We can only view the world through one linguistic imaginary. Comes perhaps from the fact that most of us only really learn to speak one language as a child. And that's something that as adult language learners, we can learn other languages. And I'm now doing that. But to all parents listening, I think the greatest gift you could give to your child would be to teach them a second spoken language from as young an age as possible to the point of fluency.
You said a second spoken language. Does that, would you say, so I'm guessing you would say study Latin, study English, and then another language? Because Latin wouldn't, would you say Latin doesn't fit into that category?
I don't think Latin fits in that category unless you're going to find one of the rare communities in which language is spoken fluently and speak Latin fluently. Yeah.
So
building on that point of imagination, right? I just think that that's so critical in so many domains, and your imagination is part of a human being. And I haven't been to Africa, so I won't claim to know what is or isn't operating there as you were describing with your sister, David, but you know, here in Oxford, meeting students from all over, in the workplace, in the schools that I've been in, I think the imagination is largely a function of what you put in. And if you're putting in a lot of the same sort of very simple stuff from the internet or modern culture, you're not as adaptable. You don't have an intuition or a vision for how to handle a situation that you're confronted with. And I think that's another area where classical education prepares people for not just going back to be teachers, but for all of life, because you've got that much more sort of vicarious experience to draw upon when you face something, even if you're facing a conversation with somebody who kind of looks like they wish they could look at their smartphone. If you have real conversations and great ideas in your mind, you're going to get a lot farther engaging them as a human being than if you two are screen watchers together.
Jenny, were you going to say something? Sounded like you were going to jump in there.
That's a really good, I would really heartily agree with it. I think probably my classical education has given me a lot more material for imagination, which leads to then, you know, the desire to ask more questions or questions from different perspectives. And I see that in other classically educated students who are, I encounter in research contexts now that, it seems like often they have more that they're drawing from when they're asking questions about their research or investigating topics, even in seminars and things like that here.
It seems like for a long time, classical education has maybe one of the ways that we've limited it is we've focused as much as we have on the things that we learn or the things that we know. And it seems like what you're advocating for is a classical education that leads to a fuller way of living, like a fuller way of inhabiting the world and a way of seeing the world and a way, and like even a way of thinking about the world. And it's not just about the things that we know. Would you say that that's true?
Honestly, I don't know.
So Ty, you said definitely, and Jenny, you said what? You said I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe you'll want to let Ty talk. And
okay, Ty, you were definitive. I'll let you go first.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, David, one of the things I've been thinking is that I'm not so sure that we've put the right second word in terms of education, right? So classical experience, maybe, because as I go out, I've just done an MBA at Oxford University, and one of the final experiences in that course is they bring in an instructor who has deep, deep knowledge of Shakespeare's play Henry V. Hmm. But then that play is approached as a lens into how to change oneself. And of course, you look at Henry's evolution from his history and the prior plays and his the demands placed upon him, the situations he confronts, the choices that he makes, and he moves through it. And also just looking at that overall idea of change, identity, purpose. And actually, this is designed for mature students. It's also the kind of thing you could see taking out into the community or into or an organization. And I really don't think classical education is only for primary, secondary, and higher education. I think we need to be thinking about it as a way of life, an approach is kind of the word you used. So that's why I agreed so heartily. I think it should continue.
Jenny, do you want to respond?
yeah, sure. And I guess I'll just be really honest, and you can take this part out of the podcast, David, if you want, but I've tried to be really careful about using the term classical education because I don't really feel like I know exactly what I mean when I say the term anymore. And I think it can refer in so many different places and times to so many different things. And I want to be really careful to steer away from saying that I think that classical education necessarily makes people better for the world, or forms people in a way that is good. So I guess I have a lot of hesitancy to be able in answering this question.
So you're basically saying we have to define the terms.
Yeah. And I think in defining the terms, we find that every school in the States has a sort of different understanding of what it means, not to mention the different sort of movements, but that we all sort of want to lay claim to a tradition that we've only begun to explore and that has a lot of hidden, you know, icebergs underneath the surface. So I think in stepping out of the movement, and again, you know, I'm talking to you as a friend and someone who is, you know, is part of the movement, not so much for the podcast, just in explaining it, my desire in stepping out of an active role in the movement has been to try a desire to understand what was it when we say classical education, classical means the ancient Greeks and Romans. It means the paideia, the content and the methods that they were using that were then sort of revived and modified by the Christians through the Middle Ages and then in the Renaissance. But what were those really? You know, how much have we really figured out what Augustine and Cicero and Quintilian and Erasmus and Hugh of St. Victor really meant by classical education? They all meant different things by it. They all had, and you know, and Christians and non-Christians and people of different religious affiliations had extremely different and divided opinions on what it was and how it should be done through the centuries.
So
I guess I Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that I think that's a totally fair response. So I guess my question then is, given that we've only begun to crack the surface or begin to explore, I think maybe was the term that you used, what should our approach be in our homes and schools, given that our knowledge of what this is limited, given that in our lifetime, you know, depending, I mean, each of us will be able to study it to varying degrees, but none of us will ever be able to get a full grasp of this. It's going to take generations if that ever happens. So given that, given those limitations, how should we do our best to put what we do know or what we can explore into practice with our own kids? I've got little kids. I've just 6-year-old, 4-year-old, and the 1-year-old. So these are things, you know, like how should I put that into practice with my young children in my home or at Ambrose where you taught? What do you think about that? Is that too broad of a question?
Ty, do you want to start?
I think it comes back to what we were discussing before, David. It's about love. So the step to put these things into practice is to love good things yourself. I think that's always the first step and the most important. That's what I most remember from my experience growing up.
Is that what?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's a really hard question for me to answer, because I think that any question where I'm offering parents advice on how to raise their children is really terrifying, because it has such eternal and important ramifications. And oh gosh, I guess I would say, don't look at classical education or any form of education as something that's going to be a savior or something that will keep your children safe. I think that, or something to be done one right way. When I remember, you know, mistakes that I've made or mistakes that I've encouraged other people to make as a teacher, in parent-teacher conferences and advising, I think most often when I've failed as a teacher and in the classical education movement, it's when I've asked too much of something that I knew too little of. And when I encouraged others, parents, teachers, students, to look at something that is not meant to be a savior, not meant to create perfect, you know, to create perfect children or virtuosos or solve marriage problems or pornography addictions or, yeah, you know, to hope too much in something that we don't really even understand very well yet. And so that I don't sound like I think that classical education is of no value, I do see that there is a potency in truth, in spending time with truth, beauty, and goodness that sort of is in the nature of the things itself. So the closer that we can get to loving, to the things that contain truth, beauty, and goodness, the more time we pour into loving them and understanding them for ourselves, and the more we can sort of get out of the way. I think I've heard your dad say this a lot, to get ourselves out of the way so that students and children can experience and fall in love with the truth, beauty, and goodness in great literature and languages and art and so on and so forth. The more, the better. And I think just to add two things to that, perhaps, that just come to mind is, firstly, is discipline. And I suppose that could sound like a contradiction to sort of being with great art and music and enjoying it and loving it for its own sake. But, you know, to be able to read, as I'm, you know, as I'm doing now, De Amicitia by Cicero in Latin fluently, to be able to love that and to experience the beauty of that requires a great amount of dedication and effort put into learning a language. And the same goes for sort of all of the higher level things that we get to experience in classical education, I think. And I've forgotten the second, so I'll leave it with.
I'm not sure I remember the second part anymore either. Well, so let's talk about the things that you are doing, you know, to pursue your own studies and the things that you love. You're both living in England now. You're living in Oxford. Mm-hmm. First of all, how's that been? That's a very general question, but is it what you hoped? I mean, is it everything you dreamed, living in the place where C.S. Lewis walked and all that?
I think so. I think it's nice. So you're referring to we're staying at the Kilns, C.S. Lewis's house, for 33 years. And one of the great things about that is it's a community of scholarship, as well as a place that lots and lots of people visit and come into. And so this life that's shared with quite a few other people has been a really rich experience for us, versus, you know, we kind of had our own single family home with lots of space back in the States. And I think both of us, well, I'll speak for myself, right now it doesn't feel like I could go back to that, because that's just too alone and independent, versus living with other people who are also, you know, not the same. Everybody has their own pursuits here, but committed to a similar kind of life.
So you'll have people coming into coming in there to do their own writing or their own studies, and you're taking care of the property. Is that right?
Yeah, we kind of hold down the fort here, and then we've got three other housemates who are here doing degrees or long-term study at Oxford.
Okay.
And then we have additional people coming for either a short tour or for a few days or weeks for their own studies. So it's a whole range of different kinds of visitors.
Hmm. Have you found that interaction with that wide range of people has influenced or expanded your own studies while you've been there? Because you're both studying at Oxford, is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think, honestly, the people who come here aren't very diverse. So it's a lot of American fans of C.S. Lewis.
I guess that makes sense.
So I would echo what Ty said in that it's amazing to live in a community rather than in a single family home. And I, like he said, would prefer to always do life this way, and never have never live in suburbia again. But I think that everyone asks, you know, oh, what is it like to live in C.S. Lewis's house? And it's just our house.
Yeah.
I think if anything, it's sort of de-glamorized C.S. Lewis quite a bit, because it's such a blessing and a privilege, but it's also, you know, most days there's dirty laundry, you know.
Yeah.
There's dirty dishes in the kitchen. There's dirt on the floor. We have to do laundry and vacuum. And
C.S. Lewis had to wash the dishes too.
Yeah.
So you haven't been haunted by the ghost of C.S. Lewis yet? Is this?
No, but sometimes there are badgers and a hobbit makes an appearance every now and then.
Jenny, you're studying. Can you kind of explain what you're studying at Oxford, because you could do it better than I ever could?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I'm doing a DPhil, which is a PhD on Augustine, And I'm examining the relationship between memory and language and love in his conception of sort of affective formation. So I'm interested in how he viewed memory and language and the role of those working together in his conception of time, and how sort of all of that together fits in with his theory of education, especially liberal arts and moral education in his Paideia. So a big part of that has been studying Latin and investigating ancient theories of language. And it's been really wonderful.
So you've talked about how, you know, the idea of we only have begun to crack the surface of understanding what classical education is. Is there anything in these studies that you've been engaging in the last few years and the way he understood education that surprised you or made you rethink the things that you'd always thought about, or the way you'd always thought about education, or something where you thought, man, if I could go back to my classroom, I would redo everything again because of what he taught me in these studies?
Yeah. Well, I feel like my answers might be really disappointing because I've actually been really trying not to apply this yet, because I think one of the things that was hard for me when I was teaching on a daily basis, and speaking at conferences and sharing resources with teachers and training teachers, was always feeling like I knew so little about the history and the roots and the practices of classical education that I was, you know, that I was claiming to be teaching from. When we say classical education, again, I think we like to cite Plato and Augustine and C.S. Lewis and the medieval tradition, but I at least hadn't really read thoroughly in that tradition. And so what I'm really trying to do now is not to say, okay, I'm going to read through Augustine and see what I could apply to my classroom. I'm just really trying to understand him and his world on his own terms. And I know that later, I think sort of like all through my life, I said, I'm not going to be a teacher. And then sort of organically, everything that I was taught and was given did shape, undoubtedly shaped my pedagogy. And I hope it will again. And I pray and plan for it to again. But at this point in time, I'm really trying not to study with that sort of aim, because I think it will narrow the lens with which I read. I know that's not very helpful.
No. I mean, in some ways it is, because I'm just going to ask another advice question. Would you suggest that that is the way we should pursue all of our studies, and teach our children to pursue their own studies?
What do you mean?
In the sense that you're going to try to you're not going to try to apply what you're learning to something right away. Sometimes you just have to kind of, I don't know, I'm going to use this kind of vulgar word, but you kind of have to wallow in it for a while. Is that, as opposed to just trying to say, I'm learning this for the sake of doing this way, or for some other motive, as opposed to kind of learning it for its own sake and trying to kind of follow the truth that you find in it, or the truth, goodness, and beauty that you find in it. That's kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm babbling.
It depends on your vocation. I mean, if you are an architect and you want to read Vitruvius in order to build a house, then you should read Vitruvius in order to build your house.
Right.
I don't think there's anything immoral about that. But I think I just am really grateful that I've been given these years to read Augustine and to read the tradition without having to think, okay, you know, what am I going to say to these teachers, or how am I going to teach this to eighth grade girls?
Yeah. So I actually appreciate that you know, sometimes I do interviews with people, and I'm not trying to throw any particular person under the bus or whatever, but I'll do interviews with people, and it's like the rules are so hard and fast. And I appreciate that your, I don't know, flexibility on them, or your acknowledgement that some things are going to be different for different people in different contexts and things like that. I feel like sometimes we would do well to even think about our own students that way, that the way the things that we're teaching them aren't going to mean the same thing to every student. And, you know, they're all individuals. And even though there's universal truth in the things that we're teaching, how they experience that or what it means to them in practice or in life is varies from student to student.
Yeah, I think that's really true.
So Ty, you have been getting your MBA at Oxford, right?
That's right. Yep.
So what led you to get your MBA at Oxford in particular? Was it because you guys were already over there?
Basically. So Oxford has a nice executive MBA program that's one of the most international groups of people studying an MBA around, because it's done in a way where you come for a week at a time and then you go back to wherever you came from. In this case, I came from Oxford, so I don't have very far to go for 5 or 6 weeks, and you work at your job somewhere else.
Okay.
And it's designed for people who are more senior in their organizations. A lot of MBA programs for people at that stage are weekends, and so they're regional, right? People will only drive a few hours to go for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So because it's set up that way, I was excited to be part of the Oxford Executive MBA, and I have colleagues everywhere from Singapore to Rwanda to South Africa, Liberia, Russia. It's extremely diverse, and that's important, because going back to this, getting other kinds of experience and seeing other people as in themselves worthy of just of knowing and appreciating, that's what I've been doing.
Have you found that studying this at Oxford has led to? Have there been things you learned in the MBA that were in opposition to the things that you have studied in classical education? And then were there any things in it that really jived with that really profoundly with what you had learned in classical education?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Business studies seems like it's such a unique and almost, I don't know, maybe it's not modern, but it feels like a modern way of thinking to me, the way of pursuing studies. Am I wrong in that?
No. It's extremely pragmatic. So, you know, it's simplest version of it is, you know, you have a goal, there's some sort of problem, how are you going to solve that problem? And each class is approaching that basic setup with some different sets of tools that you're going to pick up and run with, eventually hoping to combine them all together. That's the idea, the general business education. So I suppose that's very different from the contemplation of truth, goodness, and beauty for their own sake, right? In this, Aristotle would say these are only means to ends and not ends in themselves. So therefore, they can't be the highest good. I still think there's a real dialogue there between business and classical education, because even going back to that simple setup I gave at the beginning, you have a goal. Well, where did those come from? And so even at Oxford, even you know, with these great colleagues and these great professors, I do find that getting a goal when you don't have one, or trying to figure out what your goal should be, that's the challenging part. And that's the part that's not often provided by any kind of modern education method, really, right? It assumes you have a goal already. And I think in practice, people take those goals from their environment or from suggestion in the media or the state, perhaps. So, Yeah, there is a little bit lacking in the way the MBA goes, but I would say coming into it with a good background, it's valuable. Mm-hmm. I certainly found it valuable because anytime you have a collection of people trying to do something, leadership becomes very important and you do have pragmatic things to do, right? Mm-hmm. We have to live here and now.
Yeah. Yeah. To take care of the people who you're responsible for and who you have authority over and so forth. Well, I've kept you for longer than I said I would. I guess this is my last question. This is going to be a simple one. Other than the things that you've been reading in your studies, what are some of the best books that you have been reading just for fun? Maybe there's nothing you've been reading outside of your studies because you're so busy with your studies. If that's the case, then that's fine. But is there anything else that you've been reading that has been particularly moving that you would recommend?
I have to say that I cannot separate my studies and my fun reading. It all sort of blurs together, which is wonderful. But
yeah, that's a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would recommend, I've just been falling in love with Cicero, which is a funny thing to say because I never thought I would love the Stoics, but Cicero's De Amicitia it's a book on friendship. And it is one of the most beautiful books I've ever read. So that would probably be my number one recommendation. That, and then there's a part of his book, De Republica, called Somnio Scipionis. It's the Dream of Scipio. And it's about the immortality of the soul, but also it's sort of the foundational picture of classical cosmology. So the painting of the heavens and how the seven heavens are mirrored in our souls and why desire points us back to our home in the stars. And there's a lot of interesting foundations for a lot of Christian cosmology in it. And it's an incredibly beautiful part of the Republic. So, I have to mention Augustine. So, Augustine, his commentaries on the Psalms, and especially for anyone who reads Latin, it's really easy Latin. So much, much easier than sort of classical Roman Latin, but his sermons on the Psalms never fail to move me to tears. And so those would be my three.
Mm. I've never read those reflections on the Psalms. I'm going to check that out. Ty, what about you?
I don't know how often you have books like this recommended on your podcast, David, but,
pretty wide variety. So
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think C.S. Lewis would have read this book.
Perfect.
A book that, was recommended, at an Oxford talk, saying, you know, we have a lot of things happening now that are happening because people first read about, these ideas in books. So Google Earth is a famous example. It was first in a science fiction book. Later, engineers realized they could actually build it at Google, and they did.
Wow.
A book that's interesting in that dimension is called Remembrance of Earth's Past. So, and this is a translated work coming out of China, a Chinese science fiction trilogy that is wildly popular over there. So if you want to know what future Chinese entrepreneurs and builders might construct out of what they've been reading, that's a good book to get into. And it's very enjoyable.
And what's that called again?
Remembrance. Of Earth's Past.
Okay.
So
okay.
Of the Earth's Past.
Well, there's two more to add to my ever-growing list. Well, thanks so much to both of you for joining me for this. I think that your story, I was thinking while you were talking earlier that you both sort of represent or come from at least one of the first generations of people who grew up in, you know, this so-called renewal of classical education, and studied that and then have continued your studies and are teaching and beginning to speak and write and all those kind of things. Or I guess you have for a while. Beginning maybe the wrong term there, but you could represent that generation. And so I think a lot of people encouraged by that story, by your stories, and, you know, probably are able to look at what has been done even in its infancy, in the, you know, even in the infancy of the renewal, and can be encouraged by what they're doing and have some hope for their own children, because that's kind of what everyone was after when they started doing this in the early 90s in the first place. And yeah, there's still, we've only scratched the surface, but at least scratching the surface is a start. So you guys seem to be the result of the beginnings of the scratching, I guess. So I think that's a good thing, you know, and then we just, you know, just have to continue it, right?
David, this is the first time I've ever been called an itch that needed to be scratched. But it's a good metaphor. I like that. I like that metaphor of scratching the surface, because it's not grand. It's very humble and small. And I think that, I think it's beautiful.
I think each of us can only do a little bit, right? Like, even if you spend your whole life studying it, you can only scratch that surface so much.
Yeah.
So, and I think, you know, sometimes I'm just going to mix a whole bunch of metaphors. Sometimes we also bite off more than we can chew, and that leads us to have expectations that are unattainable.
Mm-hmm.
So having attainable expectations for our own studies is probably a valuable thing too. It's not like you're studying everything at Oxford. You're studying something at least somewhat narrow.
Yeah.
But you're going to know that really well, clearly. Well, again,
we're all finite, right? So I think, I hope that, you know, this is valuable to your listeners, David, and we certainly are grateful to be the product of those first scratchings of the movement.
I think it's
I think things are, there's a lot of ways that things can go well, and
yeah.
I think parents should feel confident if they're pursuing the best that they see, that's going to work out in a way they can't even imagine yet.
Yeah, and I think what you're kind of getting at is that there's, you know, what we are is part of a tradition. I think Jenny used that word earlier, and, you know, even Augustine or Cicero were part of a tradition. They weren't the whole tradition, they were a part of it. And we can each kind of try to be a part of that, or even if we're not contributing to the tradition, at least trying to understand the tradition in some small way is sort of contributing to it in its own way.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's a really beautiful way of putting it.
Well, again, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much, David.